Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 5. This week, Bob broke down the autopsies of Sheila and Liz from the Ballfield double homicide. This episode has raised a lot of questions, and we are going to get into all of your listener questions. Today, I'm joined by Bob and Janet. But before we get into all that, do we have any housekeeping?
Oh, yeah. Just one thing I wanted to throw out to everybody. I've only had a chance to listen to the first episode, but the BBC actually has put together a podcast on Sandy Melgar's case and Jim and Sandy's daughter, Liz, who you guys all know from being on our show throughout season six, is a big part of it. And she's participated in it. This is in the Innocence Project of Texas is all on board with everything that they're doing and putting together. I believe the first two episodes are out as That's of right. now.
Yeah. I listened to both of them. Yeah.
You've listened to both already.
Mm-hmm.
From what I heard in the first episode, it sounds really good. Like they're doing a really good in-depth analysis of it. I know that Mike and Allison from IPTX were super excited for it to come out. They've been posting about it. Liz has been posting about it. So just for more information and another kind of perspective on the Melgar case, go check it out. It's called Hands Tied. I don't think I said the title of it, right?
No, you didn't. Hands Tied.
Yep. It's called Hands Tied. It's by the BBC. So check that out and give that a listen. Other than that, there's a little bit more housekeeping, but I think we had questions about the stuff that we need to talk about.
Yeah, Jenna had just wanted to check in on any updates for West Memphis 3 to start.
Yeah, so when we're recording this, it's Wednesday night. At this point, it has been 8 business days since the hearing. So I know we had said that it was that the evidence was supposed to be packaged and ready to be shipped out within 10 days. That was 10 business days. So the day you're hearing this on Friday, the 15th, that will be the deadline that was set by the judge for everything to be shipped out. So as of right now, I haven't heard anything and I'm kind of operating under no news is good news. Things are probably moving forward because if something had come up that was a problem, I would have heard about it immediately. And I have not heard anything that anything's going wrong. So as far as I know, everything's still on track to get shipped out by the time you're hearing this episode, because I believe that would be the 10 business day mark.
Okay, great. And then Jenna had also asked if there were any updates on the series that Ed Ates did that, you know, had started airing, but we weren't sure about Ed's episode. I don't even want to call it by its name because I don't want anyone to watch it, but.
It's terrible. I watched it. Ed had reached out and Ed did not watch it. Ed reached out and just said, hey, the episode is airing. He was upset about it. And then, you know, he was just saying like the way people at work are kind of looking at him, like he's just really uneasy about the whole thing. So I bit the bullet and watched it and it is disgusting. Oh, and it is worse than I could have possibly imagined. I don't know what's happening from here, but something is going to happen. I know Ed and IPTX, you know, Allison is looking into. So we told you guys what happened already. You know, yes. That they there's all the drama about them, you know, kind of lying to Allison and kind of hiding the polygraph from Allison, all that stuff that went on, the way they had Ed in a room. So keep in mind, as far as the polygraph itself is concerned in those standards, I noticed when I saw it, because I had bitched out the showrunner about this after I found out everything that went down. And I was like, you put Ed in this hot room. There's all these cameras and people and all this stuff in the room. And he's like, the room was not, it might've been a little warm. It wasn't bad, but no, it was just him and the polygrapher in there. That was it. And just one camera. That's all that was in there. Well, then, I mean, Janet, you've been in the business long enough to know when you're watching a show and the camera is moving and panning around the room and it's cutting to reaction shots and angles. And like, there were at least three cameras in the room and three camera operators in the room during the time, plus all the lighting and all the other stuff. But anyway, that's not the best. We already knew all that shit.
Right.
And then, you know, the way it went down was when they sat down, you know, I connected with Allison literally while Ed was getting his results. And while he was getting the results, that's when we call, you know, we Allison found out, we got on the phone to Ed and Kim and told them, you know, just get out of there right now. When they left, they called us and they told us what the results were, which was that they asked if he had killed Elnora and he said no, and he passed that. But that they asked him if he knew who did, and they said that he failed that question. And then they started like pushing all these angles about his mother and all this stuff about that. And Ed was right. Well, if you want to be disgusted, let me tell you what they did. The way they edited it together, they said they only asked three relevant questions. One was, did you ever actually ask Kenny Snow to lie? No, it passed. Have you ever driven Elnora's car? He said no, and they said inconclusive. And then they said the only other question they asked him was, did you stab Elnora Griffin and kill her? And he said no. And so this is what happened in real life. They said, we asked you if you murdered her. You said no. You passed. Then we asked you, do you know who did it? You said no. You failed that question. What they edited together was them saying, we asked you, did you kill Elnora Griffin? You said no. You failed. They completely and removed the actual question that they said he failed. And again, I don't suggest anybody fucking give these assholes even a millisecond of your time with a clip. But if you have watched it or you do watch it, you'll see how insane it is. Because then the polygrapher is explaining the results and he keeps saying, these results, I don't think that he committed this murder, but he definitely isn't telling us something. He knows something that he's not telling us. He knows who did it. They bring in another, he Skypes in with another examiner who reviews the results. And the guy, and again, they don't show him asking the actual question. He's like, well, we reviewed it. What do you think? And he's like, I agree with your conclusion. He didn't kill her, but it seems like he probably knows or has an idea of who did. Now, I know what happened. That is the most disgusting, fucking horrible fucking thing I have ever even heard of someone doing to another human being. That's affecting his real life. People that he works with, people that he knows, people that Kim works with. Just watch a show where they said he failed a question about, did you murder that woman? Which was not at all what happened. But if you get beyond that and you just watch it and pay attention to it, it makes absolutely no sense. They keep saying he failed the direct question, did you stab her and kill her? And what that tells me is that you didn't murder her, but you know who did. The reason they keep doing that is because they removed the fucking question that they said he actually failed. It is the most disgusting, deceptive editing I have ever heard. And I hope to God Ed is able to sue them for fucking millions of dollars. It is the worst thing I have ever seen in my, and I don't even know what the hell they did to everybody else in this show. I mean, the entire thing from beginning to end was factual error after factual error after fact. It was the most piss poor, just terribly put together, horribly researched show of anything I've ever seen of its kind. And I've seen some bad ones. And the whole time they kept saying, so they wanted to really build up the Kenny Snow angle so they could have the good moment, right? The that moment right before where they're like, you passed, you didn't ever ask him to lie before they hit him with the other one. But they kept saying that Ed confessed to Kenny Snow. They kept saying that, which was never even what Kenny Snow testified to. If you're not familiar with that season two case, was that Ed had asked him to lie and point the finger at someone else, which Kenny then later admitted was a complete fabrication. It was totally a lie. He did it to get a better deal, or to get a deal in his own case. So we already knew it wasn't true. But the thing, and then because they couldn't use Meyer Allison's interview, they brought in some crime writer I've never heard of. Some other people may have, not to you know, shit on her. I'm not familiar with her, but she knows nothing about the case. She just read into it and she gives a, 30 seconds of commentary about the Kenny Snow thing. And she says, I'm reading the document and it says that, he asked him to lie. And then the narrator comes back on and is like, so basically he confessed to Kenny Snow. Like, they just kept saying it's that kind of shit through the whole thing. But what they did at the end is unconscionable. Like, they should go to fucking jail for what they did. I can't. We have other things to talk about. I really didn't plan on getting this worked up over this. I knew that we were going to mention it, but it's infuriating. It's absolutely infuriating what they did. And it was just egregious.
Yeah.
Absolutely egregious. And I'm sure what they said, that what they would say is, well, we said that he didn't do it and that we just think that he knows who did do it. But you told the world that he failed a polygraph question that he didn't fail, and your bullshit polygraph anyway.
Well, there were a lot of people who would like to help Ed in any way they can. So, however, yeah, whatever I happens and whatever we can help with, I do not want that family to go through any more than they already have.
Yeah, it's horrible. I haven't spoken to Ed after I see it. I texted back and forth with him. He was supposed to call me. I think he's just kind of crawled into a hole right now. I did speak with Kim, like actually talk to her, and she's just, they're devastated.
Yeah.
They're devastated that for them to do this to a person, a real person with a real life that they're building together, is unconscionable. I just got to stop. I'll rant about this for two more hours. I'll let you know if there's any updates on that. In the meantime, let me try to
reset. Man, I know it's hard.
My blood pressure just went through the roof.
I'm sure. No, I'm. I feel sick. I feel sick.
Yeah, me too. But okay, let's reset.
Okay.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient unlocked. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Okay, now we're getting it back into the details of this case. This is, I don't know how you guys like listening to them, but these are the types of episodes that I love putting together, where it's just, I tell people are like, what do you do for a living? I'm like, I don't really, I guess if you had to put a pin on it, I'm kind of a data analyst. Like, this is what I, like, this is where I nerd out, where I get to like look at all these little tiny details and build stuff out. So, but I don't know what you guys think about it. What did you guys think?
These are the episodes that I love. I love episodes like this. This feels like old Truth and Justice, where you just hammer down on one thing and we get to the bottom of it. Now, with that being said, I'm baffled at things in these autopsies, but the episode is exactly what I love to hear.
Yeah, the lack of consistency, detail, and clarity in the autopsy reports is extremely frustrating. It was for me. It's like, why does this one not have, like, how big was the entrance wound? Like, why don't I know with that? You know, what do you mean you don't know if it was a gunshot wound or where the wound, like, what do you mean? Like, put a rod through the hole. Like, that's what you do. Anyway, Janet?
No, I mean, I also, I really, really appreciate these episodes. You know, it is in stark contrast to my lack of experience really investigating things like autopsy reports. I mean, there have been a couple that I have been very invested in for, you know, personal reasons or for reasons to do with this show. And it's very, very helpful to have someone walk you through what you're really dealing with, what you're looking at, and what's missing. Because I think that's a big part of why this stuff is important. To your point, you don't necessarily know when you're just like reading through a report, you don't necessarily know what you don't know, and you don't necessarily know what to pick out that feels like a weird oversight or a very significant lack of information in some way. So I really appreciate you drawing, you know, circles around those things. And in true Truth and Justice style, obviously, it cracks open a bunch of questions about the crime scene, about behavior, about credibility of witnesses, about all of that. You know, it's impossible for us all not to want to leap forward into. So I'm sure you will have some classic answers, which are, don't worry, we're going to get into that, because it does it does raise a lot of questions for people trying to put the pieces together, as it were, and figure out what really happened.
Well, I was going to say before, I don't know how many questions. I can't see the questions because I'm remote. But I would like to talk about that wound to Sheila, that shot in Sheila's head for a minute, if we don't have any questions about it.
We do.
Well, let's just go ahead and we'll talk about it and we'll see if we get to the questions.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Go ahead, Zach.
So that is probably one of the more confusing things of this particular two autopsies, is that shot in the head that does not penetrate, that does not exit. I still am very confused, even by the size of the entry wounds. The size of the entry wound is even vague in the autopsy. Saying that it is a half inch to a quarter of an inch, that is a big difference.
Half inch to three quarters of an inch.
So, yes, I apologize. Half inch to three quarters of an inch. It's a quarter of an inch difference in size. That is a big difference in size. So what size is it? I mean, that's a huge... I mean, I know you don't know the answer, but that's what I'm saying. Like, what size is it?
Same question, yeah. Like, that's like, how can you... There's other wounds where... I've just finished writing the house crime scene autopsy episode, and there are a couple of wounds that were like, was like shot at an angle, and you get, you know, like skin's flexible, and so like if it's not perfectly straight on, the hole's not always exactly the right size, the, you know, a perfect circle, and there's like one that says it's 3/8 by a quarter inch.
Yep.
Right. And it, so like, you know, it's like, okay, so it's 3/8 this way, a quarter inch that way, that makes sense. But this one, it says it's a half inch to 3/4 of an inch. It's like, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me, because like you said, if it is shot at an angle, it will elongate the wound, right? You know, it's still going to have the same height, but the wound is going to be longer. And in that
sometimes one... also, and that's kind of the dynamic nature too. I had to do a lot of this research today because of the other one. Sometimes depending on like the, you know, if it's like skin on bone, or if it's like a more fatty area, because of the way the skin will flex and stretch, sometimes it'll shot an angle and it'll actually, the hole will end up being smaller than the projectile, because the wound, like, it's hard to explain, but it kind of stretches as the bullet passes through it, and then it snaps back to its normal size.
The strangest thing I've ever heard.
So imagine that. So imagine like a balloon, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's a bad example because it's going to pop. But, you know, so... if something is like stretched way out, say something's 3/8 of an inch, right, in diameter, and if you're pushing it through something that stretches way out before it pokes in, so that fiber is stretched way out, but then after it pokes through, the fiber retracts back to its normal size, then the hole that's left behind would actually be smaller than what went through it, because the fibers were stretched when it went through, and then they came back.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. It's still strange, though, with the, a velocity of a shot out of a firearm seems like it would break the skin too quick for it to really stretch it that far.
I thought so too, but I did. I spent too many hours today researching that exact topic. So it turns out, yeah.
So I do think the theory you have is very interesting. I don't know if there's any legs to it, but I think it's very, very interesting that maybe it passed through somebody, such as a hand or something, because that projectile does have to open. I think we've talked about it in different seasons, and you discussed a little bit. When that soft projectile from a bullet is just lead, right? And it's fairly soft. It expands once it hits something hard. That's what you talked about, maybe the cushion. It really wouldn't expand through that, just to give everybody an idea, because right. It's not hard enough. But that lead will expand, which will cause that wound to be bigger. So that is a very interesting theory that it could have passed through somebody else first, because I don't know what else it would be out there, but it definitely went through something, in my opinion.
And then going back to the entrance wound size, the only thing I can think of, I have a picture of it. It's not the greatest picture of it, but the reason we get that 1/2 inch to 3/4 inch is because it's irregular, which then again tells me that bullet's probably already mushroomed and deformed before it hit the skin. Mm. And that's why it's such a weird shaped entrance wound. Yeah. And then only penetrating, your head's not that wide. And for it to only, the bullet's completely fragmented, it only makes it, halfway through the brain tissue and doesn't even come to the other side of the skull even. It tells me like the bullet was slowed down and it was already deformed and it was already breaking apart when it went into her head.
It would definitely have to hit something very hard to lose that much velocity to already be expanding and to lose that much velocity that it doesn't exit. It would definitely have to hit something pretty hard, like bone.
Yeah, well, and I'll circle right back to you, Janet. But on that note, I've examined a whole bunch of 38 caliber shots to the head today for the other case, and whatever gun those were fired out of, it seemed like the farthest that projectile will travel is to the skull on the other side. So we have one where the bullet fractured the skull on the other side and was found. Like just inside of the skull, but fractured it. One where it broke through the skull on the other side, and the bullet was between the scalp and the skull, so it stopped there. So if we're talking about the same gun or the same type of gun, like that's maximum. And those were like one of those was like point blank, and okay. That's as far as it traveled, which tells us I think that we can rule out, say, a 357 Magnum.
Yeah,
right. It's a lower velocity round to only travel that far. It kind of leans me more towards the 380. To be honest with you. Hmm. Janet, what were you about to ask?
Well, I'm asking a layperson's question, to be sure. So hopefully this is helpful to someone besides me. But in the context of that, if you are looking at this in a report, who is the person who would be putting two and two together who isn't you, Bob? Like, would the medical examiner ever kind of like extrapolate that information into this is how this wound may have been caused? Is it the detective's job? Do they go seek an expert, sometimes that information just sort of float away, like no one is really catching hold of it and figuring out what it means?
If it's being thoroughly investigated, right? So if we're talking about an evidence-driven investigation, not a suspect-driven investigation, and they're just trying to figure out like what happened here, and part of the what is the how, and you need to know like what gun was used, what happened, because this could be a significant finding, especially it would have been a significant finding then. If, say, for example, it did pass through one of the offender's bodies.
And they bled.
There's blood on the scene, and you're testing all that blood that you just assume is the victim's, but also maybe that's the offender's blood there. So typically, like a good medical examiner will document in detail everything. The wound tracked here, this is how big it was, this is where it went. But generally, they're not going to give their opinion on what that means.
Because they're not supposed to, right? It's supposed to kind of be a wall between like...
Yeah. So they provide the data, and then the detectives would then take it and then start doing kind of what I'm doing. And then the detectives would then want to deploy, like go into their like forensics department and try to figure things like this out, right? So they would look at the what's left of the projectile, all the different things at the forensics. They could even bring in experts. But then it should all be done on the investigative side. So from like at the direction of the detectives. And then once you get to trial, then you would have either, if there was an expert that, or ones that, you know, a forensic, somebody in the forensics department or an expert, you would have them, you, the order would be, you would put, to do it right, right? You put the medical examiner on the stand, you ask all the detailed questions about the wound to get it on the record, and then you bring on the expert and say, okay, this is what we know, what does this mean?
Like a Dr. Lee or a Dr. Spitz or one of, you know, someone like that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And is it fair to say that, I mean, I know that you don't see an explanation for it in the autopsy reports. Can we look forward to any of that analysis showing up in the files that you're reviewing? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't. I mean, I've glanced through some of them, but this is one of those cases where there's so much information. The whole idea here is that we do things in real time. Usually a lot of times I'm ahead, but like in this case, we're very much going in real time because there's so much data that, you know, I can't get distracted by, I had to stop myself when I'm reading. I'm like, okay, well, let me go find these forensics reports and see like what, but it, like that's another 6 hours
right.
that I don't have. Like I need to focus
sure.
on this. So you're kind of getting it as I'm doing it. Like the episode I wrote today for this week for the house crime scene, like I'm investigating and researching and doing things literally as I'm writing the script. So like I have like my outline, my base, all the research I've already done. And then I'm like, okay, this thing, what does that mean? And then I'm like researching. I have Dr. Spitz's book here. I'm online, even using AI to ask some questions, at least direct me to where to look. And I'm like, what does this mean? You know,
sure.
All kinds of different questions like that along the way.
Well, I guess, yeah, I'm not to imply that you're not getting to something fast enough, more just like because of what we know about how quickly it turned to one suspect who confessed. I'm just wondering how much of that work we'll even see evidence of, or if it was like,
I'm
I don't know, why would
we'll
we
see...
why would we need to know that? We got our guy.
Yeah, I'm not confident we'll see any of it because so far everything I've seen is they figured out who it was, and then all they did is look for evidence to try to convict him. And just as a side note, that should be coming as long as we work our schedules out. I did speak with Liz Ayer's daughter this weekend. Mm. We spent about a half hour, 45 minutes on the phone, just not interviewing, just talking about the case and things like that. And I'll say this, she did say that she's going to do an interview with me.
Great.
So you guys will get to hear from her. So we get a little bit more about the victimology, and it's actually pretty revealing. A lot of it is, but she also spoke to how her family was treated by the police, and based on the kind of that conversation, I would say that I don't expect that there was any of the things that you would want to be done were done.
Okay. Well, if you want to get into some more of these questions, we may tread on a little bit of the material that we've already covered. So just holler. I just want to acknowledge these folks, and some things are connected to earlier questions, but also that lead into new questions. So Colin says, hi, Bob. Could Liz's head injury have somehow been caused by her head hitting the rocks when she was moved into the woods, like if she was picked up under her arms and kind of tossed against them?
No, I really don't think so. So that injury, the difference in the way it's broken down in the autopsy and the way it was described at trial when I read the testimony, I was like, oh, well, they hit her over the head with the gun, with the handle
right.
of the gun, obviously. When I looked at the pictures from the autopsy and read the actual detailed description of the autopsy, no, this was a massive wound. For those that are on YouTube and can see, so it's like kind of like a triangle, like 5 inch by 4 inch, like triangle flail of skin that is ripped away. The skull is crushed from like here to here, like a linear fracture through this whole thing. The indentation in the middle of it was that oval shape, but the skull fracture was big. So because of the force that was applied to fracture the skull over that big of an area, as well as the tearing, because this is a blunt object that tore the skin that bad. And so what that tells me is it's something that was like if you imagine, like I think Zach had mentioned last week, like a tire iron, like something like cylindrical and heavy, like a pipe, a tire iron, something like that, that is just swung hard enough to hit and tear the skin in that big of an area and to cross the skull. There's no way that wound was from, you know, her hitting her head on a brick. There's no way.
Well, Susan had a strong reaction, as you did, to this question around potentially not doing an assault kit on one of the two women, and is just wondering if that means something nefarious, if that means information is missing, or if it's just a huge oversight, or what that could possibly be about.
It's hard to say because, like I said, the autopsy is lacking, in my opinion, in a lot of ways. I know from just conversations with the attorneys and with Dr. Jackson that there was a lot of DNA testing done on both victims, like later after the trial. So I don't know. Like it's possible there was a sexual assault kit done. But what I noticed was, and for those of you that have been on the website and have looked at the documents, at the bottom of Liz's, it says a sexual assault kit was sent. And at the bottom of the report for Sheila, it does not say that a sexual assault kit was found. So I don't know if that's just another oversight in the report or if it really wasn't done. Mm. Either way, it's troubling.
Right. Yeah. And likewise, you know, Susan has questions about what you were just speaking about as far as the weapon that was used on the skull, just sort of already kind of wondering, like, is this a situation like we very often come upon with these cases? Of is this intentional? Is this, you know, subterfuge? Is this, you know, someone removing information, or is it a lack of attention to detail and a lack of respect for the victims as these investigations are being conducted? And just feeling that giant question mark of could it have, you know, it does it help the case if it was a second weapon, but that implies there were two people and they only have one person that they've arrested? So would they just sort of be sloppy intentionally about any of this to kind of help their case, or if it's just, you know, bad work?
In reading the trial transcripts from the prosecution's case and their witnesses, the impression that I get is, one, he is intentionally not getting into the weeds on anything. Mm. So I think that they want to rely on the confession statement and just get the jury to, I don't think that, because you'll see when we get to that part, like, he didn't want the jury to be looking real close at details in this, because the whole thing falls apart if they do. So, like, you see, like, you know, Dr. K, I don't remember how many pages it was, but for a medical examiner to testify about five victims, the testimony was incredibly short. I mean, it's just like, what were the wounds? It's this. Yep. It's this. Yep. It's this. Yep. He did not want to dig into it. And some of that might have just been basic trial strategy of, let's not get everybody confused about all these little details. I want to stay focused. There's probably some of that. And then as far as the weapons go, yeah, I mean, they only had one person on trial and they didn't arrest anybody else. So, yeah, they certainly didn't want to put any information out there that might suggest that there was a second different weapon involved, because then, you know, the jury might start asking questions like, well, wait a minute, if there was a 45 caliber and a 38 caliber used, why is there only one person arrested for this? Who's the other guy? And the, you know, nothing adds up. So yeah, the questions were very much directed to, which, I mean, in this case, it's horrible because Chris Bynum is, in my opinion, very clearly innocent. And I think that the prosecution was well aware of that. But, you know, in a prosecutor's defense, like once it gets a trial, like that's their job, right? Just as a defense, as far as, you know, they're going to ask the right questions that are going to help win their case, which is what he did. But the balance is supposed to be that the defense is well read into the case and then can combat that during cross-examination. And I think that's where we're really lacking here. For example, the shot through Liz's chest. Okay, so there's this kind of narrative being put out that it's 138 caliber round used in both cases. It was Chris Bynum that did it. Well, then, you know, so he talks about at trial the shot through the chest out the ribs on Liz and just breezes past it. The prosecutor does. Now, if you had a defense attorney that was fully read up on the case, really investigated it and paid attention to it, you know, put the kind of detail into it that we did this week, then in cross-examination, I'd be asking, what was the diameter of the entrance wound on that shot through the chest? Is that consistent with a 38 caliber? You didn't find a bullet. And how is it that the shot to the head only tracked 6 inches before it ran out of velocity, but the shot to the chest that we don't have a diameter for went a full foot through the body, busted through a rib and completely cleared the body, and we don't have a bullet for it? Like, how is that? And then obviously, you know, I'm not a lawyer, as I always say, but, you know, for me, if I was the one doing the questioning, I'd be like, so is it fair to say that there is a possibility that those two wounds were created from two different firearms. And I think that an honest medical examiner would have to answer yes.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen.
Right.
Hey, everybody. Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Gary says, and a couple people had a question similar to this. Could the laceration on the neck on one victim be from a bullet and enough to slow down and cause damage to the bullet that ended up in the other victim's skull?
No, I don't think that anything lines up as far as trajectories. Again, if we're talking about 38 caliber rounds, if they're consistent with the other 38 caliber shots that we have from both crime scenes, if the shot, first of all, there's no exit wound from the neck. I had mentioned the episode. Hopefully some of you went on the website and looked at the autopsy. The diagram makes no sense. So when he's describing it, he talks about, and again, if you're ever able, any of you are able to watch us live on YouTube, you can see these videos, but like the one shot went in here and then out here on the same side, on the back of the head here. So he shows entrance, exit, which is kind of a weird angle as it is. But then another entrance way down here. But all he calls it is a laceration. doesn't say, he doesn't determine if it's a gunshot wound or not, doesn't track the wound, like, didn't, like, they should be able to, like, dissect and find out, like, well, what happened after it tore the skin? And we don't get that answer, but it went in, it didn't come out. This wound back here in the back of the back right of the head was definitely the exit wound from the shot in the front of the head. So that one, and if you take it how, you know, all the other shots to the head, with, and that was, I believe that did have a 3/8 inch entrance wound, which is consistent with a 38 caliber. You know, they barely made it to the skull. So like, that's not going to then continue and break through another skull and then embed into the, like, there's no way that that's going to happen. So no, and then again, this can be, I'm being confusing right now. It's because the report is like, that neck thing is insane. It's insane to me that all we get is, oh, by the way, it's like in the middle of describing the track of the wound through the head. It's like, oh, by the way, there's also a laceration to the neck. Don't know if that's a bullet. Anyway, back to the head. It's like, what? And when you look at it, it looks like a bullet wound in her neck. Hmm. But there's no bullet in there. There's no other exit wound. Like, was she stabbed with a stick? Was she stabbed? Like, I have no idea what that meant. But that's a long answer. The short answer is no. There's no wound that I see on Liz that would account for a bullet being passed through her and then into Sheila's body.
Got it.
I don't think so.
Donna says, do you have any pictures that the ME took of the bullet evidence collected? In my county, the ME packages evidence bullets recovered during autopsy in envelopes marked with the location they were recovered from, and they take pictures of those packages with the items. That could answer the question of which location the lead fragment was recovered from.
Yeah, so funny you should ask. I had this frustration today as well, because there was questions in the house episode, the house crime scene, where, you know, in that one, if you remember, there was 9 wounds that we were trying to figure out, were there 9 shots or was there doubling up of some of these wounds? And so I'm literally counting from trial testimony from Bertozzi, counting how many bullets were found on the ground and how many bullets were found in the bodies and trying to figure out what went where. And I want to see that, you know, because there's, you know, at one point he's describing, you know, there's a copper jacket found on the, well, is it just a piece of a copper jacket? Like, could the piece here and the piece there be from the same bullet, or is it an intact copper jacket? So I go through the trial exhibits to look through all the pictures, and the only pictures they put into evidence that we have photos of are the, he did exactly what the listener was describing, but the only ones that we got pictures of that were there in the file that were at trial are the bullets that were found inside the bodies. So like the cards will show projectile found, you know, in Anthony Jeffers, and then there's like a, like it's written on there in head, and you know, that's where they recover. But none of the bullets that were found on the ground we have any pictures of. Now, I would assume somewhere in evidence those are still packaged somewhere. They were collected. They just, it's another one of those things, or they just didn't put that information out at trial.
Hmm. Elise, and then we kind of get into a little bit of victimology here. So anything you want to skip past. Elise says, do we know why Sheila had dentures? Do we know why Liz was missing teeth? And then also just wanted to confirm whether the reports were on the website. Liz was having trouble finding them.
Yeah, I didn't get them up on the website until Tuesday, I think. Mostly because I thought I had already put them up before I left to go out of town, and I had not. So they are up there now when you're hearing this. I don't know about the dentures. I don't know why Liz was missing teeth, but I know that she was already missing teeth because there's, you know, I'm reading a statement that Michelle gave to police when she's like describing them, and she mentions that you can't miss Liz. She's missing a tooth, you know, whatever. So I don't know what the reason is for it.
Sarah says, does the autopsy cite the condition of Sheila's feet? If she was forced to walk barefoot, her feet would be damaged.
You know, that's a good question. And that's maybe a miss on my part, but I'm trying to think from the pictures. I don't see anything, but there's not a good angle of it, but I'll look that up. And actually as we're talking, Zach, do you have access to your computer right now, Zach?
Yeah, I'm trying to pull it up right now.
Thanks.
Yeah. If you pull it up there should be a section it's probably under extremities where it should talk about.
Great question, Sarah. Thank you for that. Richard says, do you think it's possible or likely that Sheila was being pulled along by her wrist while her pants were around both ankles. This would likely lead her to trip, especially if she stepped on the leg of the pants during the walk, and this could explain the scrapes and bruising.
I think it's very possible. I mean, the bruising that she had on her wrist, I think, are an indicator that maybe she was grabbed and dragged along like that. As far as, I don't know if like her pants were around her ankles the whole time. It's very possible. Because the reason I say that, one, I don't know. And two, I don't think that would be a necessary piece of the puzzle in order for her to trip while being dragged through the woods in the dark. So like either way, I think it's very possible that she like, you know, tripped and stumbled on her way through the woods.
Okay. Jessica says, a little information about Darvocet. As a preamble, Darvocet was taken off the market in 2010 due to high addiction potential with minimal help with pain. Though I heard from my nurse mother and former nurse sister, it also caused heart issues. It falls somewhere on the synthetic opioid spectrum, being stronger than tramadol, but weaker than Vicodin, though it has a Tylenol additive too. I thought that was very interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, do the records show if she ever had a prescription for Darvocet? If not her, then maybe a family member like a mother or grandmother. I only ever heard it prescribed to older patients. And two, do we think maybe the people who killed them perhaps could have been a drug or drug money dispute? I know cocaine is obviously a street drug, and despite Darvocet having street names, I have never, ever, even when I was in NA, heard of people addicted to it, though it's possible there are just better alternatives. Two really interesting points.
Yeah. One, the as far as the drug itself, I remembered the only person I've ever known in my life that was on Darvocet was my grandfather. And I feel like I remember one time, like I had a horrible toothache and he gave me one to help with it and it didn't help at all. It's not a super strong drug. Like I said, it's weaker than Vicodin. It's stronger than a Tylenol, weaker than a Vicodin. Yeah. And it's not a common street drug you hear because it doesn't have too high of an effect. As far as whether she had a prescription for it, I don't know. Maybe we'll come across something like that later. I highly doubt it. But also because of the metabolite level in her blood, even if she had a prescription, she was taking way more than a normal prescribed amount. Like, you know, it's considered toxic to have 500 nanograms per milliliter or more in your blood, and she had like 1,474. I think it was almost triple the toxic level in her blood. So it's an interesting thing because from what I read, it tracks with what you're saying in that it was highly addictive, but it also didn't really produce much of a high. Yeah. So I don't know, but yeah, I agree. It's just a weird thing to be kind of thrown into the pile of other weird things in this case.
But I think to your point, the indicator that she would not be feeling the effects of that, I think is a very, very good point because you hear, oh, she was on opioids. But then when you hear about what it was and also what her tolerance must have been, like, you know, that's part of the problem with addiction is that it takes more and more to feel anything at all. And most of the time, what you're then doing is chasing feeling normal. So you're not even chasing feeling high. You're just trying to get back to normal feeling and sober feeling.
Right.
So I'm sure, that it wasn't like, oh, she was high on Darvocet. Like, I definitely highly doubt that.
No, the results do not seem to indicate that at all. And that was the thing is when I first read it, I was like, oh, look at these crazy levels of this opioid. She's probably high. And then also like learning the distinction between, which I didn't know until I was studying was researching for this case, the difference in timings and effects of metabolites versus the parent drug. Zach, did you find something?
So I'm not seeing anything based on extremities on either of these reports that are up on the website.
Okay. So that's interesting.
Wouldn't they even just say like feet or unremarkable or, you know?
Yeah, I would think so.
I can't seem to find anything on them, but I will keep looking.
Real quick. No, you're right. Yeah, that's
okay. I wasn't just missing it.
Anything about
that's
hands?
Interesting.
Like scrapings?
Normally,
fingernail scrapings, bruising to hands, defense wounds.
No, I mean, only marked in, there's the external examination and there's nothing mentioned about the feet and then injury. So the way these are laid out, every autopsy is a little different, but they usually kind of follow the same track. So there's always like the basics, then like identification, then external examination, then, and again, nothing about the feet there. And then injuries And so we go through all the injuries, and then it's the internal examination where it goes like break down piece by piece by piece. But usually there is a section for extremities. I'm going to do a real quick keyword search and see if I can find anything. One last try for it. Feet. No, I'm not seeing it. Okay. So yeah, seems like they're, you know, I didn't miss it. It just wasn't there.
That's kind of wild. Sarah, different Sarah, two great Sarahs who always have great input in our Facebook, by the way. So our other Sarah has a series of really, really good questions. I suspect that, again, they are kind of getting into victimology or behavior and maybe something that you're going to break down. So we can put a pin in it if need be. But Sarah says, do we know where the nearest liquor store to Michelle's house is in relation to the ball field?
We do. We'll get into it later. We do know there was one not too far.
Was Michelle asked about eating anything with Sheila prior to Sheila and Liz going to the liquor store?
I guess I can share that. And so that was the reason I like sought out Michelle's mm-hmm. statement. And no, because that's exactly what I was looking for. And no, there's nothing about it. There wasn't anything about even, again, no focus on victimology. Like there was no like, what was it like? What were you talking about? What was going on? What was she doing? How did she seem? There's none of that.
Next question. Are we positive the only connection Sheila and Liz have between each other is Michelle?
It does seem to be the case. I mean, there's no evidence that they did. All we have is Michelle saying they didn't know each other. They were both her friends. And like she had said, they maybe had like come in contact with each other at her house before. But that wasn't a normal. As far as she knew, that was the only time they'd ever been together.
And then do we know if Liz's right ear was also pierced, noting that the pearl earring was noted in her left ear in the autopsy, but nothing about the right?
Again, this is the inconsistencies in these autopsies. And I don't know, maybe Dr. Kim was just overwhelmed because he had five to do all at once. But it just says that she had a pearl earring in her left ear. As far as I recall, maybe I feel like I went back and after I saw that question and looked and there was nothing in there. But then in other autopsies that I'm going to be covering this week, it says both ears are pierced. The left ear is pierced. Like, those questions are answered, but it's in her case, it's not.
Yeah. Juan had asked, I think, a question that we had touched on in a past episode about the ball field, whether it was known to be a popular place where illegal activities occurred or whether this was more rare. I'm not sure we had an answer then. Do we have one now?
I still don't. That's one, you know, we're definitely going to get in as we break into, once we're done with like the original source data analysis and we start getting into like, then that's where we like kind of develop our list of questions for those that are new, the kind of the process, right? So we figure out, okay, now that we know everything we know, and now we know what we don't know, then we'll start, you know, asking, you know, trying to come in contact with people that have the answers to those questions.
Right. And then last one, just which again seems like it could lead into next week's episode. I could be wrong, but Patricia says just some thoughts and questions. Does anyone else think Liz sustained more injuries and thus was perhaps the target of the two? And then she says, wasn't it Liz who received the page that caused her to leave for the liquor store? The person paging Liz wouldn't know Sheila was with her.
Very good point. And yes, it was Liz who got the page, made the call, and was leaked. Because remember, according to Michelle, Liz asked Michelle to go to the liquor store with her. And she's like, nah, I'm already in bed. I'm not going anywhere. So then Sheila said, well, I'll go with you. Like, that's the way this went down, according to Michelle. So then that's that. So yeah, so it was never the plan for Sheila to be going with her. As far as Liz taking the brunt of it's hard to say, like you say target. That to me almost feels like there was a plan to do this, and it doesn't seem like that there was a plan to do this to me, right? It seems like something broke bad. And as far as who sustained more brunt of the attack than the other, I think it seems like, and according to Tasha, Liz's daughter, when I talked to her this week, that like Liz would fight. And that's the kind of victimology we want to know, right? And when we see, we haven't talked about this in the episode, but with the shirt, like to me, that really paints a picture for me. The shirt and so again, you had like, if you imagine if you're facing someone and they grabbed with their right hand the left side of, say, the bottom of your shirt, right? And they're trying to pull your shirt off. And so as they're like pulling it up and you take your left arm, and you kind of put it up so the shirt pulls off that arm, but it's still on your neck and it's still on your other arm. And then with the angle of the shot that goes in her chest, but then comes out down below the armpit, what I'm picturing is someone like with their right hand yanking that shirt. She's pulling herself away from the shirt. So she's bent over towards the person. And then with their other hand, like with their left hand, they reach out and shoot her in the chest while her while she's bent over that way. Like that's the fact that the bullet hole is in the shirt, the one side's up, the angle of the wound, like that to me is that seems very clear to me that's what happened there. And then where the given the amount of blood in the blood trail is why I suspect that the head that the hit to the head have, because you know head wounds bleed a lot. And there, if you've looked at the crime scene photos of the blood trail and the drag marks, they're like all that blood is not from those scratch marks on her back. Like that, she was bleeding profusely at that point. So the head wound happened somewhere before she was dragged into the woods. Also, I want to give a shout out, and I'm going to give a bigger one when we actually do this episode, when we actually recreate the crime scene. But listener Colin Shorthand, he sent me a couple of emails. This dude spent a ton of time doing some incredible work, and literally like the where I thought it's so hard to tell from those photos, right? Like where is that drag mark? Where does it start? Where does it end? Where is it located? Colin took and like literally found markers like in this photo, here's this one little tree. And then if you look at this photo from another angle, we can find the same tree. And if you look at from this angle, we can find the same tree. And the cars in the background here and the dugouts in the background here, and we can still see this tree and we can anchor stuff together. And I went through it. It's incredible. I have it all bookmarked for when we get to that episode. But again, I keep saying, cause I know this episode, I can tell from the number, we have a lot of new people that are in here listening. Like this is how we work. Like it's like, I'm the voice. And then the whole idea is that all of you are helping in any kind of different ways. And like, that is like such a perfect example. It's incredible. The work that he did. We'll be highlighting that. I may even sneak him on the show to talk about it because he did such a good job of it once we get to that point, if he's interested in doing that. But yeah, so anyway, I'm rambling, but I just realized we hadn't talked about the shirt thing. And that to me, that was when I was able to piece that together, it was kind of like the first moment in this insane crime scene where I'm like, oh, that now makes sense to me. I can see how that happened.
Is it getting too much into the weeds of a future episode to ask you if that motion to pull at the shirt was like a control motion versus like a I want to take your shirt off motion?
Well, there's no way to know because we don't see it until she's laying there dead in a different, you know, at a different location. And that's just the condition of the shirt. So for me, I'm just trying to think of how does a shirt get into that position? How does it get to where your left arm is pulled out of the sleeve and the sleeve is inside out, but it's still around your neck and head and your right arm is still in it. And then, so I'm like, so how could that happen? And then it's okay. Well, then if we couple that with the angle and trajectory of that gunshot wound, that's going downward like that, down and back. And then the fact that we have the bullet hole in the shirt. So she was still wearing the right side of her shirt when it happened. It was just, so to me, that's, I couldn't tell you that this is what happened, but to me, that's what I see happening is either trying to pull the shirt off or even like grabbing her by the shirt and her trying to get away.
Yeah.
And we've seen.
Just because the two actions are so different, like the aim of those two actions are so different. The aim of I want to take your shirt off and do something versus like I'm shooting you now. Feels like it would be more like you're trying to get away because they have hold of your clothing. But if you can squeeze out of your clothing or wriggle away somehow, then maybe you have a chance.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think, I didn't mean to say that like it was.
No,
like,
I didn't think that. Like, I'm clarifying in my own head for
any like sexually motivated reason.
Yeah, I was just kind of imagining.
But the way I kind of picture it is almost like she's trying to run away, and they're like they grab her shirt, and then you know again like we've seen this on the playgrounds, right? You know, they're grabbing them by the shirt, trying to pull them back, and the person will turn around and face them and duck out of their shirt to get loose. I'm kind of picturing something like that. And then they pull the one side off. And then during the process, you know, they have a gun in there, would be their left hand, and fire through there. Or there's a second person that's part of the whole thing. But it feels to me, it feels like the shirt getting pulled into that position and the gunshot happened. And to me, they happen in the same incident. like at the same time. They were happening simultaneously, I think.
God, it's fascinating and so disturbing. And I really hope that we feel like we get some more clarity about what horrible thing happened to these poor ladies.
Yeah, I hope so too. And if nothing else, I mean, I was really, it made me feel good talking to Tasha. And I have contact information I'm going to be reaching out to this week to Anthony Jefferson as well. And hopefully, you know, I have a similar reaction there. But Liz was very grateful for what we're doing. And it was, she was very happy with the fact that this work is being done. The story is being told in a way that is letting the world know that her mother was a person. Because it she just feels like no one's ever really cared. And I know all of you that are listening do. And, you know, that's really important to me and Janet and Zach, and all of you. So with that being said, we're going to continue doing this work. We've got a long, long, long way to go in this case. On Sunday, I was telling Janet and Zach in the Patreon pregame show how excited I am for everybody to hear Sunday's episode, because we're doing the same thing. We're going through the autopsies from the house crime scene. And it was just a lot of times, you know, I read through things a few times, put together an outline, figure out where I'm going with it. And then I'm like, okay, I think I know where this is going. And I think I know the big revelation that's coming from this. And in this case, I thought I had it figured out. And as I started breaking down the details, it was like the thing I thought was going to be important turned out to be way less important than I thought it would be. And then something I never saw coming came out of left field, or revealed itself when I actually started doing some research, that is a pretty damn big deal and helps us get a much better idea of what happened that night. So tune in Sunday. It'll be 6 a.m. Eastern time. It'll be live. Listen whenever you can, whenever you want, and we'll talk to you guys.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
Moto Casino. America. a social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.